Coming up on this episode of DL Weekly, set a date to run away with Mickey and Minnie, unexpected price increases, more chances to hang out with the Plaids.
Another Wakandan moves into DCA, a peek into holiday festival foods. We finish our interview with Imagineer Greg Combs and more. DL Weekly starts now.
This is your captain speaking to you from the wheelhouse. I'd like to welcome all of you aboard the DL Weekly podcast. For safe passage on our trip, please do not sit or climb on the outside railings, and be sure to watch your children. The water can be unpredictable in these parts, and we'd sure hate to lose any of you.
Hello and welcome to this episode of DL Weekly for the week of October 12th, 2022. I'm Teresa Urban.
And I'm Teg Bushman. We'd like to send a shout out and a big thank you to Anne D for becoming an official weekly tier on our Patreon. Our supporters get some pretty fun perks like DL Weekly swag, bonus content, access to our Discord community, and more. If you would like some more Disney magic in your day, head on over to dlweekly.net/support to join the community.
Well, our friends over at All Enchanting Ears have been busy. They are making fun and unique ears, plus ear holders, straw toppers, lithophanes, and so much more. They are offering a special discount code available to weekly tiers. Be sure to use code DLWEEKLY for 10% off your entire purchase. Head on over to allenchantingears.com and check them out.
Now let's get to the news.
Well, the kickoff to Disney's 100th anniversary will be centered at Disneyland. To begin with a bang, Disneyland announced the opening date of Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway. Starting January 27th, guests will be able to take a trip through the El Capitan Theater with Mickey and Minnie. Now the rest of Mickey's Toontown is not going to open just yet. Just the attraction will open on January 27th.
So this is interesting. Like, I want to talk about the attraction itself, but the first thing that I thought of is, well, this is, I mean, it's sort of near the front of Toontown.
You have like one little pathway.
Yeah, one little path
that's going to be straight shot to the back there.
That's going
to
be done. I was not expecting this to open this soon. I thought it wasn't going to open until all of Toontown.
Yep.
And the last time we saw any type of aerial or anything, video or photos of this, like, there's not a Toontown really.
Yeah, last time we saw Toontown, it was Dirt Town.
Yeah. Dirt Town.
Dirt Town, yeah.
Mickey's Dirt Town.
Mickey's Dirt
Town. I'm very excited for this.
This was unexpected, but it's so exciting. And we had heard rumors that the attraction itself was pretty close to being done. And really, they were just finalizing and finishing up a lot of the facade work. But, I mean, if you think about it, it makes sense because that big, big building has been up for quite some time now.
True.
So, and they can work on that 24/7. It doesn't matter, because even when Toontown was open, it wasn't, you know, in the building. So it wasn't like it was interfering or doing anything that messed with, like, with guests. Whereas Toontown itself has not had as much time. Plus, quite literally, they're working from the ground up on some of those areas. Mm-hmm. So I think this is really exciting. What a way to start the Disney 100 by opening this attraction, I feel, early, because I hadn't heard any whispers that this might even be a thing until they announced that it was happening.
And I will say, even in the Disney Parks blog post, they said it's going to open early for that. So I was like, that's cool. The thing that I'm most excited about with this attraction is we rode it in Disney World. It was a great attraction. There's supposed to be a couple new things just for the Disneyland version. Mm-hmm. So very excited for that to happen.
Well, and I'm just excited because when we rode it at Walt Disney World, it was the fall of 2020. So they didn't have some of the things in the queue that were supposed to happen happening. So we didn't get to experience the full storyline that is you in the queue and then you getting kind of pulled into the movie. We didn't get to experience that part.
Right.
So, and that I heard is a very, like, to see that effect in person is like amazing.
Yeah.
Like, people like look at it and are like, how like, are perplexed.
So would that be
how it worked?
Would that be like with Rise, if you didn't go on the ship and you just walked in and suddenly you were on the hangar bay?
Sure. Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. I can see that being. I'm excited.
Like,
I'm
a
excited.
Good story point.
Well, not only will Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway open for the celebration, but the icon of Disneyland, Sleeping Beauty Castle, will also see a makeover. The castle will celebrate wonder with platinum banners and bunting and accented with the three good fairies. One of the most exciting upgrades will be two majestic water fountains on either side of the moat. Finally, a wishing star will sparkle atop the main kind of center large roof section of the castle.
This, I'm really excited to see what this looks like in person. The concept artwork that they have actually is really quite convincing. It's not, it almost looks like a photo. Like the, it doesn't look like our traditional concept art. It almost looks like, oh, they installed this stuff, took a picture, and then took it all down. So I think we get a really good feel and look as to what this is going to look like. But the thing I'm the most excited about, which is the funniest, weirdest things, is the fountains. I'm so excited for these fountains. I think they're going to really, really add to the look of the castle, even though it's not technically the castle, it's the moat. And the other thing that I find real fun is I like that they have incorporated the three good fairies into the main kind of Bunting banner there. So you've got Flora, Fauna, and Merryweather holding that up. I thought that was a really fun touch, especially given that it's Sleeping Beauty's castle. You couldn't get away with doing that at Cinderella's castle as well.
Right. One of the things that I really enjoy about this is we just got this castle renovated not that long ago with the new paint scheme that looks amazing in person, especially. And my concern is usually when they do these kind of decorations, they put stuff on top of those turrets and stuff, which causes them to have some damage because weather and stuff gets under there. It's not easy to clean off, etc. This time, they're doing all of this kind of bunting. They're adding a couple little things up at the top that are they're kind of like accent pieces that are not covering up the natural beauty of the castle and really just kind of accentuating. But I'm with you. These fountains, I am beyond excited for these fountains because I believe this will be something that stays after the bunting comes down.
I think so too.
Now, I've been to Disneyland Paris, and Disneyland Paris, they have water jets in their moat like World of Color, like Fantasmic. So I'm almost wondering if they're going to add or have any type of ability to do anything there that might go along, or these fountains, just as they are in the photographs here, might go along and be part of the fireworks show. Yep. Which will be really neat.
I think you could do that with the fountains as they are. I do, as much as I would like to be able to have these turn into like mist screens, I think with how...
Oh, no, I don't mean mist screens. I mean like World of Color where they like shoot up high and stuff.
Oh, that kind of fountain.
And they turn colors and everything.
Got it. I thought you meant like...
No,
like how the fountain turned into mist.
I'm sorry. I can see why you would have thought that.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I can see that to a degree. They wouldn't be able to be quite as intense because those pools aren't that big. So they could very easily overshoot.
The whole hub is a splash area.
Yep. Anyways, I'm really excited. I think it's going to be very, it's nice because it's just, it's like an enhancement of the castle.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
not like it's being taken over or something like that.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, because I agree with you that it's adding to, not overwhelming, the castle.
Well, this isn't something that's very exciting to report on, but it is something relevant. Unfortunately, ticket prices have gone up yet again. They went up this Monday. On average, the ticket prices increased $5 this time. There is an additional tier of tickets, though, which moves the previous ticket levels down. So they now start at tier 0, which was the old tier 1. Pricing has remained $104 for the new 0 tier ticket and increased to $179 for the tier 6 level, up $15 from last time we raised prices. Adding park hopping now costs $5 more at $65 per ticket. Multi-day tickets went up between $30 and $35 per ticket, and preferred parking and hotel valet parking has gone up $5 and $15 respectively. Genie Plus is now $25 per day, and they have implemented demand-based pricing with no high-end price announced for the service. However, good news! Web Slingers is now a normal Genie Plus attraction and is not a per-experience lightning lane like it was before.
I mean, that's a plus. I just think the demand kind of wasn't there for it.
Well, you know what, though? I saw quite a few people in that line. So
I mean, that's
true. I think what they may have decided to do there was Disneyland currently has one paid lightning lane, Rise of the Resistance.
Right.
Whereas DCA had two. That always felt a little
weird.
Off, kind of uneven to me, but I mean, what do I know?
Yeah. Ticket prices, not too bad per thing.
No.
We've talked about this at length on the show. I feel like they should leave ticket prices where they are and increase the Genie Plus price by a lot to kind of make some money there and kind of deter some use of it, which we've talked about at length.
Yeah. So we just had a good question in the chat. Tara asked, what is demand-based pricing? So prior to this ticket increase, Genie Plus, no matter what day, $20. Yep. Did not matter if it was the busiest day of the year or the absolute slowest day of the year. Did not matter if you were the only person buying Genie Plus or if you were one of million, not millions, but you know, one of the thousands and thousands sure. that bought it. Whereas demand-based pricing could mean a couple of different things. It could mean higher, how do I want to say this? Higher or more popular days could see higher pricing for the Genie Plus service, or it could be based on that day's usage. If nobody's buying it, they're not going to raise the price. But if they have a surge in people buying it, they might raise the price up. Basically, my thought is they're going to be doing this to try and somewhat have some control on leveling out how many people are using it. Sure. They have not said that there's a cap. I think that's really what they need to look at is doing a cap. If it were up to me, if I was in charge of the Disney universe, I would have raised Genie Plus by a heck of a lot more, because sure. I really do think that Genie Plus needs to be a premium price and it needs to be a premium service. Yeah. So if I were in charge, I would have raised it to $50-$75 per person per day. Does that sound steep? Oh, yes, that definitely is steep. But my thought is you have fewer people using those lightning lanes. That not only makes the value of Genie Plus go up, because right now, if you're going for your lightning lane reservations, sometimes like Haunted Mansion Holiday, that lightning lane line is spilling out into Splash Mountain. It's a crazy long line. So you're not really getting, you don't really feel like you're skipping the line per se. You're just waiting in a line, but it's different. Whereas if it were more tightened, if you had fewer people using lightning lane, then you truly would be walking to the front of the line. That might be something that would be worthwhile to some people to pay that extra huge price. However, the bigger plus that I would be more excited about is less people in lightning lane means better movement for the standby lane, because you're not having to pause and wait for all these people to go past. So I really think it'd be a better balancing of the system if they were to do that. Now, I know that's probably not the most popular thought process, but that's, if I were in charge, that would be what I would do.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. So our friends over at Concierge, James, one of the concierge over there, in our chat earlier, talked about the variable pricing. So they haven't disclosed what that's going to look like at Disneyland, but currently at Walt Disney World Resort, Genie Plus guests, the price will vary based on the date a guest is visiting. Similar to theme park tickets, throughout the year, prices may be lower on less busy days and higher during peak periods like Thanksgiving and Christmas. For example, now through the end of October, prices are $15 per guest per day.
Really?
On less busy dates, and $22 on some of our busier dates, and somewhere in between on other dates. Plus tax, prices subject to change beyond October, etc., etc.
That's surprising that Walt Disney World's Genie Plus is...
It's been cheaper.
Below what our Genie Plus is.
No, theirs has been 15 really? When ours has been 20.
Really?
Yep.
That's
it's been that way since it launched. So
that's very surprising to me.
Well, Star Wars Galaxy's Edge is not immune from inflation and price increases either. Building a droid at the Droid Depot will now cost $119.99 plus tax, an increase of $20. Savi's Workshop was also increased the cost to build a lightsaber to $249.99 plus tax, an increase of $30.
This is what a fun middle part of our discussion. We're talking about prices going up on things, and here's Teresa talking about wanting prices to go even higher on other things.
Yeah, right.
But you know, I'm not terribly surprised by this, because it's really, you know, you're paying yes for the product, but also the experience. I do think that the Savi's price increase makes more sense to me than the droid price increase. I feel like $119 or $120 plus tax for building your own droid, that just feels a little steep to me, since it's not quite the same experience as you get when you go to Savi's to build your lightsaber. To build a droid, for those of you that haven't stepped foot in the Droid Depot, it's just kind of this little separate area in the shop that is kind of like this little conveyor belt. Sure, cast member kind of wanders around and kind of helps you out, but it's very, you kind of do a lot of it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like someone's really guiding you through the process.
And it's plastic.
Yeah. Whereas the, now I haven't done it, so Tay can speak to this better than I can, but whereas building your own lightsaber, why, yes, you are still technically putting, you know, putting the pieces together and doing that part yourself. They really kind of, it's a much more immersive experience. To be able to get in there, you have to have the reservation and you can only bring one guest with you. It's a very like sought after thing because it's behind this wall and you can't right. go pay, you know, that whole thing. And they make it,
it's kind
very,
of a show.
Yeah, it's very immersive. Like people get emotional and like just talk about how awesome the experience of it is. Yes, of course they're excited about their lightsabers too, but I feel like you're paying more for the experience right. than you are for the actual saber.
Yeah, but also like I said, so with the droid, you're building these smaller kind of droids. They're made out of plastic, where your lightsaber is made out of like metal, and you get like there's a lot of electronics too, and stuff. Yeah. Yeah, but I just feel like the bulk of it, it feels solid, you know, like sure, like sure. like a quality item. And like you said, it's kind of the experience of going in and having this. You have a couple cast members that are helping you out. You have this show that kind of goes
very,
on.
Very well themed and all.
And I've said in the past that the old pricing of $199.99 is worth it just for the experience. I do feel like now we're getting into the quarter of the way to $1,000 yeah. and it's kind of
yeah.
So I think if they increase it any much further from this, there'll be less people that are going to be able to do it. However, I'm also surprised by even the old pricing, how many people had lightsabers mm-hmm. walking around. So apparently it's not deterring enough people from it, but it's just kind of sad. We're having some inflation things. Maybe things will go down in the future. Who knows? But definitely it's not encouraging me to build a droid in the future.
Well, on to some more fun news. One of the last remaining things that went away with the beginning of the pandemic has finally returned. Guided tours have come back to Disneyland. Currently, Walt's Main Street Story Tour and Holiday Time at the Disneyland Resort tours are open for booking. Walt's Main Street Tour includes a walking tour down Main Street, a visit to Walt's apartment, refreshments on the patio of his apartment, photo pass downloads, and a commemorative lanyard. The tour lasts 90 minutes and it's $160 per person. The Holiday Time tour is 2.5 hours long and looks at the holiday traditions with a special viewing area for a Christmas fantasy parade, holiday treats, a ride on It's a Small World holiday, and more. This tour is $110 per person.
I am so excited tours are back because I've only taken one tour at Disneyland, and it was the Walk in Walt's Footsteps tour, and it was amazing. It brought me almost to tears. It was that good of a presentation. I've learned a lot of cool things from it. For me, this Main Street tour sounds amazing because the price of admission for me is worth it to get up into Walt's apartment.
So they didn't do that in the
no. I went on the version. They changed it later, but when I went on it, they didn't. For a while, the Walk in Walt's Footsteps tour went up to the apartment, and you got to ride on the Lily Bell, and that was like this whole thing. Well, not anymore, but for me, getting up into the apartment and being able to have refreshments on the patio.
I think that's really cool.
That's super
really,
cool.
Really, really cool. Is it a hefty dollar amount? Yes. But I do think, for me, it'd be worth it because this is an area that us Disney geeks, you know, kind of, it's like one of like the things on all of our Disney bucket lists. And I just think it'd be so cool to be up there. And same thing with the Lily Bell. Now, we don't have a tour right now that includes the Lily Bell. Mm. So I think really the only way you might be able to get on there is through some Disney magic from a cast member, or it might be something you could do if you were doing a VIP tour. They sure. might be able to make that happen for you. But I'm really excited that tours are back. It's cool to me that they came back with new tours. So if you had done the previous tours before, this is still something for you to get yeah. excited about. Would I have liked to see the Walkin' Walt's Footstep tour come back? Yes, of course I would have, because I did not get to experience that. But I do think the Walt's Main Street Story Tour sounds incredible, because I mean, Main Street's one of those areas that is so amazing, and there's so many details, and there's so many little hidden things, and there's so much history there. But we're all guilty of it. We just kind of blow past it because mm-hmm. it's just kind of the hallway to get to the other thing. So I think it'd be really interesting to take the time to really stop and appreciate the details and appreciate the story and appreciate the history that Main Street has, and to have somebody that's knowledgeable in all this to kind of share and point this out.
Absolutely. And like I said, it was really amazing. I'm just looking here because I wanted to double check, because previously, if you had an annual pass, it did allow you to use a discount on that.
I heard that that's not a thing anymore.
Well, that's what I'm looking. I'm going through the booking process quick. and it does not look like I'm logged into my account. It does not look like it is using the discount. So it does not look like any type of magic key discount works on the tour now. I do think, again, I have not been on either of these. These are brand new tour. Well, the holiday one, I think, is one that they had before, or a version of it. This Waltz Main Street tour is brand new. If it's anything like the tour that they had before, I think it's totally worth it.
I think so. Well, and I think it sounds like you get to spend quite an amount of time up in the apartment and on the patio, too. So that's cool. And this is the first time that guests have been able to visit the apartment and hang out on the patio with refreshments. Yeah. So that's kind of a big thing. A big thing is, of course, guests have been able to visit the apartment before, but to hang out on the patio while enjoying refreshments. So cool.
I think future visits.
Some new thing to add to your Disney bucket list, because I know it's on mine now.
Now, the question is, we want to go in the holiday time. Is this holiday tour something we would consider?
Maybe, yeah. And, you know, that one doesn't seem, price point-wise, $110 doesn't feel as...
For 2.5 hours.
Deep as 160 for the 90 minutes. So I'm curious about that one. I really am.
Well, more new characters are coming to Avengers Campus in Disney California Adventure. M'Baku will make his appearance soon from Black Panther, who will be in the new Black Panther Wakanda Forever movie. Werewolf by Night from Disney Plus has two characters that are visiting. Jack Russell in his werewolf form and Elsa Bloodstone both come out after dark.
So I am not familiar with the Werewolf by Night characters yet, because I have not watched it yet. So I don't know much about Jack Russell and Elsa Bloodstone. But what I will say is the photos that I have seen, ooh, he looks creepy. And it makes perfect sense that they're introducing this character during like the Halloween and spooky season, because Jack Russell is a werewolf and he like kind of comes out. There's fog and they have these lights kind of lit up on him. He just looks, ooh, he looks spooky. He looks very and creepy. Scary. He does not look like someone you would meet in a Disney park.
We'll no.
But I am really excited about M'Baku, and I'm just, in general, very, very excited about the new Black Panther movie, Wakanda Forever. So I'm just excited to see. I just love that we're getting these. I know I say this every time we talk about new characters coming to the park, but I just love this. I love that even though I haven't watched Werewolf by Night, that the characters are already there. And M'Baku, we met in the Black Panther movie, but, you know, he's going to be in the new one, Wakanda Forever, also. So it's almost like we're getting him in the park before we get to see him on the screen again. So I just find it really fun and really exciting. I'm very happy about this.
Yeah. I love the synergy that Disney is doing with Disney Plus and their things and Avengers Campus. We're starting to kind of get a little bit of that with Galaxy's Edge as well. I wish they would have done this from the beginning with Galaxy's Edge, but I'm glad we're getting it now. Mm-hmm. And I love that we finally, it's been a while, but I'm just glad that we finally are back fully to having characters and stuff in the park. Because remember, it wasn't that long ago where we had distanced meet That's and true. Greets and all these other things. So it's really great that we have this stuff in the park. So just keep bringing them is what I say.
Well, there was a special event this past Sunday near Disneyland that was perfect for Halloween Disneyland fans. An Oogie Boogie Afternoon was held at the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana and went behind the scenes of the popular Halloween After Hours event with Imagineers. Disney Live Entertainment and Walt Disney Imagineering were on hand to talk about the event, the Oogie Boogie Bash. Afterwards, guests were treated to a special screening of A Nightmare Before Christmas. I'm so upset that I didn't know about this and that I don't have some quick instant transportation that could have gotten me there, because this sounded so up my alley and so amazing. If you were fortunate enough to be one of the people to attend this event, you need to email us and please tell me all about how amazing it was. The thing that was also incredible, general admission for this event was $30.
That's not bad.
Steal. That's an absolute steal.
I'm so glad. You know, you and I are both, and I assume listeners of this podcast are fans of behind the scenes things and learning about things. So the fact that they have something like this is really amazing. I didn't know about it until I was writing the script this evening, and I'm also sad that we did not get this. Maybe next year they'll have another similar thing, or maybe they'll have more stuff. If it was successful, maybe we'll have more stuff like this about other aspects of the Disney parks.
I do know. I was not aware of this event until I was on my Facebook aimlessly scrolling through, and all of a sudden one of our listeners, Stephanie F., was posting stuff about this, and I was like, what is this? It looks so amazing.
She went.
There was also another incredible event this year. It was a charity event for the Garner Holt Foundation, hosted at Garner Holt Productions, which is basically his version of Imagineering, and his Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, like, magic chocolate.
It's like getting a golden ticket to go in there.
Yes, because as you know, Garner Holt Production is responsible for a lot of our favorite animatronics, including Murphy, aka the dragon in Fantasmic, as well as many, many others that are in Disney parks as well as other parks around the world. So, but this event, this charity event, had all sorts of Disney voices. You got a tour of the like production floor in his factory.
Yeah.
Bob Gurr was there. I mean, there were just tons of Disney, like Disney amazing people were at this event, and that looked incredible. That was on Saturday. So this was an incredible weekend for Disney fans in the Southern California area to have been able to experience these things.
Now, to be fair, you were out of town.
I was out of town.
Doing other fun stuff.
Oh, yes.
That was not Disney related, but so it's not like you were sitting at home missing all of this.
No,
you were
but
still
it was
out
just
doing something.
Super incredible opportunities, and I'm very happy for anyone that was able to experience one or maybe even both of these events. But
wow.
just amazing.
And I told Teresa, I said, you know, if we lived in Southern California, these type of things would be so easy. Tis the season to start thinking about your holiday dining in the park. Disneyland announced 9 returning food booths for the Festival of the Holidays in Disney California Adventure, including Visions of Sugar Plums, which is back for the first time since 2018. No menus have been announced, but we're looking forward to all of the details.
Oh, I'm looking so forward to these menus because they're always such a unique and fun twist on things. There's not too many like, oh yeah, it's just regular old mac and cheese over here, and oh, here's a hot dog. It's always something fun and something festive and something unique, I guess, would be a good way
to say
it.
All of the food things are kind of like that, I feel. Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes these food events so exciting to me, is that it's something different, and there are things that I get to try here that maybe I wouldn't get to try normally. So, or maybe something that I didn't even know would be a thing, like Merry Mashups, you know, who knows what they're going to put together next, that sort of thing. So I'm very excited to see what the new menus will be for the food booths this year.
So a twist on tradition features favorite holiday foods with a twist, kind of like Teresa was saying.
Brews and Bites features, well, brews and bites.
Right. Favorite things features holiday classics infused with a festive kick.
Grandma's Recipes, which features time-honored dishes.
Holiday Duets, featuring perfectly paired savory foods. That sounds almost Mary Poppins-like.
Making Spirits Bright is featuring different holiday beverages.
You could get some flavorful cuisine with a hearty flair at Merry Mashups.
Winter Sliderland features savory sliders. They were the one that had that really good, like, steak slider.
Ooh, now you're making me hungry with that. And then finally, of course, Visions of Sugar Plums, which has sweet and savory treats. So that is the return. They're all returning booths, but this one is returning for the first time since 2018. So how very exciting.
So we have reported on this before, but a new feature will help you find your car in the Disneyland app. So when you park at the Disneyland parking area, this can now tag your aisle and section in the Disneyland app. The service is presented by State Farm and is available now.
That's exciting. Yeah, we've talked about this before.
We reported on this back when they announced it, but the exciting thing is
it's finally there.
Yes.
Well, let's end on some excitement that's Disney related, but not necessarily at the Disneyland Resort. Encanto has come to New York City for a limited time. Camp, the family experience company, and Disney have joined forces to put on the experience. Disney Encanto X Camp is a 6,000 square foot experience inspired by the film and transports guests into Encanto. The experience is an hour long and includes the courtyard, a climb up to Antonio's room and a rainforest adventure, a spin through Isabella's flower-filled room, and more. Never before seen areas like Luisa and Peppa's rooms and Dolores's soundscape door. Tickets can be purchased at the link in the show notes.
This looks so cool. so immersive. Again, if anybody's able to go and experience this, please let us know what you think. This, I mean,
you know who I think?
It's like stepping into the movie. It's, you know, so neat.
Think would do something like this. So, supporter Dave.
Oh yeah.
Lives in the Pacific Northwest, and he just did this again just the other day. If it was it today or yesterday? One of the two. He's like, well, I have a reservation for tomorrow. I'm going to go fly down. He lives really close to the airport. He's got all types of airline miles. So he was explaining this to us, and he just pops on down. So I'm wondering if, after listening to this episode, I don't know how big of an Encanto fan he is, but I could see him hopping over to New York to check out this experience.
That's not as quick of a flight as it is down to California, but man, it might be worth it just to see this. It looks so fun. I think the thing that's most intriguing to me about this is that we get to see some of these characters' rooms that we didn't get to see before. So like Luisa's room, we only ever saw her running outside of her door. And same thing with, we got a little bit of a sneak peek of a corner of Peppa's room when she was, when Mirabelle was like in the wall.
Oh, sure.
But we didn't actually get to see the full room. So I just think that is so, this just looks amazing.
I'm trying to figure out, because they said that it'll be there for a limited time and then it will move to another camp location near you. And I don't know where these camp locations are. So Fifth Avenue, Boston, Brooklyn, Columbus Circle, Dallas, Hudson Maybe Yards, LA? Los Angeles, New Jersey, and South Norwalk.
Nowhere close to us. But
no, I was hoping for like a Chicago or a Minneapolis.
Yeah,
because that would be really cool. But such a neat thing.
Yeah.
How did you even come across with this? Because this was the Disney Parks blog.
Yeah, the Disney Parks blog announced this. So very, very fun. Very cool.
Pilots, we've detected some producer questions near Jakku. Report to your DL weekly vessels and make the jump to hyperspace. The 77 Squadron will provide support during your trivia mission. Good luck, and may the Force be with you.
Welcome to Trivia Land. How are we feeling tonight? You got some great answers stored up in your head? You ready for this?
I just never know what we're getting into when it comes to Trivia Land. So.
Me either, but I, for some reason, feel in a good mood and optimistic tonight.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm feeling good for you, too. I think the listeners have sent some good ones, but some doable ones for you.
Good.
So let's see what the listeners got for you tonight.
Excited to prove you wrong.
Your first question, submitted by listener Chris Y. What is the name of the pirate in Pirates of the Caribbean who offers rum to the cats?
Isn't that from the movie? Like, it's, oh God, what's his name?
I don't know. I do not know.
It's, not Higgins.
Not Tibbs, Mr.
Not in the movie.
What?
It's just an accepted lore of the ride.
I'm gonna call him Kitty Kitty.
I don't know then. See, we've already proven you wrong.
Yeah.
Do you have a hint, or is that just it?
It's a descriptor and a common name.
Harry?
Is it Drunk Pete?
That would be a descriptor and a common name.
I'm gonna say Drunk
I
Pete.
You meant it was like all in one. Like Harry is a descriptor.
Oh no! But that is a way to interpret what I said. Yes,
I'm gonna say Drunk Pete.
Drunk Pete. All right.
Because why not? So a descriptor and a common name, Teresa.
I'm gonna say Drunk Dave.
Well, we've all agreed that he's drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Drunk Pete and Drunk Dave. Final answers.
Yes.
All right. Your second question, submitted by Keith N. What is a common cast member nickname for the Main Street vehicles?
Common nickname?
For all, like, as a group?
Yes.
I thought you said this was going to be an easy week.
Yeah, right?
I don't know.
You know what this is? This is one of those questions that we're not going to have an answer for, but when he tells us the answer, we're going to kick ourselves.
I genuinely don't know if I've ever heard this before. This isn't even like tickling a
I don't know.
A
I'm
going to
say
of my brain.
I don't think it's right, but
hurt.
The only word that comes to mind is funiculars. I don't think that's even anything.
Funiculars?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm wrong, but at least I'm throwing something out there. I feel like in two questions, you're going to have some word spill
Wheels.
Into your head.
I don't know. The wheels.
The wheels?
The wheels.
I have absolutely no
Funiculars idea. And the wheels. Final answers?
Sure.
Very sad final answers.
All right. And your third regular round question submitted by listener Louise B. In the Haunted Mansion holiday overlay, what replaces Madame Leota's musical instruments and how many objects are there?
They're musical tarot instruments. Cards, aren't they? No, those are there normally.
So there's the musical instruments are swapped out with like playing cards. So it's got like Jack's the king, Sally's the queen.
Playing cards, huh?
They're like, yeah, they're like cards or maybe like tarot cards. I don't know, but they're cards.
Okay.
I'm going to say there's 13 just because it's Haunted Mansion.
I think they're fortune cards because in that section when she's talking, I think she says something for my fortune card tree. And I thought that she talks about
star,
them.
A brilliant star.
For my fortune card tree, but I'm wondering if those things are fortune cards.
I'm just going with cards.
Yeah. Cards? Is that specific enough for you, Fern?
You didn't give me a number, though.
Yeah, you need a number.
Of cards?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I asked how many.
6.
Definitely more than 6.
I didn't pay attention when we went through there because I'm always looking at...
Well, they're behind you.
Because her ball looks like an ornament for the holiday version.
Okay. Her, yeah.
Do you have a number?
We've got 13.
Oh, 13. Oh, that would make sense.
Are you going to change your number, Ted?
I'll stay with 6.
Okay. So we've got...
But 13's a great answer.
Saying 6 fortune cards and Teresa saying 13 Nightmare Before Christmas cards?
No, I was just cards.
Cards with Nightmare cards. Before Christmas characters, you said?
Yeah, I think they have Nightmare Before Christmas characters on them.
Because you mentioned Jack and Sally.
Yeah, yep. I didn't. Uh-huh.
Did you?
We can keep that in there.
I thought I heard you say that.
I did. No, but I didn't. I didn't.
Did you or did
I? Did.
Okay.
That.
Okay. All right.
I think yep. Jack's on one. I think Sally's on one.
Okay. All right. Final answers.
Yes. Yeah.
Excellent. All right, and your fourth and final regular round question from listener Cooper C. When was the Fred Gurley No. 3 engine built, and what was its original job before coming to Disneyland?
Lumber. That, for some reason...
Lumber?
Lumber. I think it pulled lumber.
That sounds good to me. I'll concur with lumber.
When was it built?
1893. That's what I'll say.
I was going to say 18... I'll say 1863, just to be different.
Ooh.
And you're both saying lumber?
Yes.
Okay. So we have 1893 and 1863 and lumber.
Correct.
Okay. And your bonus question tonight, how much was the Fred Gurley No. 3 purchased for?
Oh, boy.
In U.S. dollars.
So was it more than $1?
It was more than $1.
Okay.
And it was less than $1 billion.
That is quite the range.
You're welcome.
I will say it was purchased for $7,000.
I was going to say it was purchased for like $20,000
or $20.
$20,000.
Okay.
Dang, this is hard trivia.
All right, we have $7,000 and $20,000. Are those your final answers?
Yes.
All right. Well, listeners, how do you think they did? How did you do listening at home? Stick around until after the discussion topic and we can all find out together.
Well, this week for our discussion topic, we finish up our conversation with Greg Combs. Enjoy.
That brings up the next thing that I was curious, because you, in your email to us, you wrote some things you could talk about that was kind of philosophical, and we talk about this all the time, and I thought this would be a good branch into it, is existing IP versus park-specific stories.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which kind of goes in what you're saying is, you know, from a standpoint of potential success, if you have a movie that's really popular...
Yeah.
And then you've got this totally unknown story for something. It's like, well, which one are we going to put the money into?
Right.
You know, how hard is that? Or what's the deal with that? Because us parks fans want more parks kind of like non-IP stuff. But it seems like Disney's going the safe route, I guess you could call it, and doing a lot of IP stuff.
It's the popular route because,
well, that's true.
You know, the vacationers are excited about meeting the Avengers or meeting, you know, like Greg was saying, where's Mickey and Minnie and all the comfort of knowing what you're kind of going to get yourself into versus the unknown of, I'm sorry.
Yep,
Pirates what? You know?
Right. No, and look, God bless you all for for thinking that that park-driven intellectual property or stories are better than stories that come from other mediums. But, I mean, this is, again, is the challenge of a big company like Disney that is as successful at attracting top creative talent in all aspects of their business. So when you get these great storytellers who create amazing movies and TV shows, and whether it be animation or live action, and you see that Disney name in the beginning of the movie, and as a guest, when you go to a Disney park, you're hoping to meet or see or experience those things that you experienced through that movie or that TV show or however you first encountered that character, that story. And so, I mean, how can you find fault with the company trying to say, yes, we love these stories. We believe in these stories. We've invested in them. And we want the guests to be able to experience them in whatever way that they choose to experience. And so it's a little bit challenging. Now, you've seen also that pendulum go the other way, where there's a lot of media content being generated on park intellectual property, right? So the movie version of Haunted Mansion or mm-hmm. Jungle Cruise or...
Pirates even.
Pirates, right. But yeah, Pirates, I guess, is the most famous example, but I've sort of blacked that one out of my mind a little bit. But that's a whole other set of stories.
The first one was amazing, but yeah.
Oh, the first one was amazing. I mean, I appreciate the spectacle of all of them. The first mm-hmm. one was certainly fresh and original and groundbreaking for so many reasons. And there became an interesting synergy of back and forth between the ride and the movies. As the movie mm-hmm. would develop new ideas, we would try to incorporate that in the rides and vice versa. And so it was really fun to see that take place. But it's, again, we're a victim of our own success. If we're going to tell these stories and they're great stories and they're popular, how do we not put those mm-hmm. stories into our parks? Now, yes, and there's a whole bunch of friends of mine that right now are busily going to scribble down notes and call me and text me. Greg, we talked about this. We know that we can tell these stories and we can, you know, do these fantastic things, and we can. And certainly the company makes those opportunities available, but they also, you know, they don't have unlimited resources. Mm-hmm. They have to think about, with each of the business units, how much money do you put into the theme parks versus the movies versus the TV shows versus whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And so as they're looking to invest that money, and you know you have a finite amount, and you know you've got to move the needle a little bit, what's going to move the needle? A Star Wars story or a new story that a young Imagineer just came up with that nobody's ever heard of before? Well, Star Wars is kind of a no-brainer. Right? I mean, can anybody find fault with us putting Rise of the Resistance in the parks? I mean, I think it's a groundbreaking attraction. It's like nothing I've ever thought I would see. And I applaud the company for taking the risk that it took to put that in the parks. I don't begrudge them for a moment for trying to do something like that.
Well, and there's risk either way you go, because right. you've got either something that is an unknown, right. so you have no idea how the audience is going to react to the unknown, or right. you've got like Star Wars. It's this big beloved thing that people, again, like we were saying, kind of hold up on this little mental right. pedestal in their head. So you're like, okay, we got to try and meet, if not exceed, these expectations. But where does that expectation lie? And then sure. did we do it or not? You know, so I don't yeah. envy any of that decision making. Well, it's easy to be a critic, but the people making the decision, I'm like, that's right. the hot seat, man.
We have this wealth of riches of stories now, yeah, right? Because yeah. you go back to the 50s and 60s, there just wasn't that big of a catalog to pull from, that's right? True. I mean, there just weren't that many movies in the vault. There weren't that many stories that were already associated with Disney. And the ones that were out there. They were all there. So they had to create other stories. They had to create their own ideas. And now that the decades have gone by, and not only do we have all the Disney movies, but now we have the Marvel movies and we have the Star Wars movies. Mm-hmm. We have this wealth of riches of fantastic stories and aspirational places that we all want to go to. We all want to be in the middle of these worlds and experience it. And yet still, you know, it's a publicly traded company that must answer, you know, to a board of directors and shareholders and say, yeah, we spent the money wisely. we didn't do anything crazy, right? We tried to do the right thing. And
the thing that's interesting too is there's worlds that the Imagineers have created that I didn't even know that I wanted to be a part of until I stepped into it in the park. Pandora is that world for me. Avatar was not, I had seen it once. Right. You know, it wasn't something that, you know, really hit home with me like some of the other properties, but that land is incredible. Amazing?
The people it's that incredible. Did that are geniuses, right? Mm-hmm. I think of, you know, that was Joe Rohde, obviously as the creative director for Animal Kingdom and for that mm-hmm. land. But, you know, I think of Jolt Gourmet, Rockwork, God, right? This guy and his team of Rockwork people, they just do amazing things. Mm-hmm. But not just the people that did the creative part. Think about the structural engineers that had to design the steel inside of those Rockwork formations to make those stand up, right? Mm-hmm. Think about the people that had to make that ride system for, you know, the big attraction. And you know, the audio animatronic in the boat ride, mm-hmm. I mean, just everything that goes into those, the people that just astound me with their abilities to tell these stories. And mm-hmm. Avatar, you know, at one time was the highest grossing movie ever. And we got a couple more movies coming down the pike here soon.
Yep.
And so how do you not, as Disney, when you have the ability to present those stories into a theme park environment, how do you not do that? You'd be silly. You'd be criticized if you didn't do it.
So I want to venture into Greg Opinion Land real quick.
I thought that's where we've been for the last hour. No.
These are I just want to be clear for our listeners and any Disney people who might be listening that I'm interested in your opinions, not the company's thoughts on these things or any inside knowledge you have on it.
Greg's opinion as a fan.
Yes. That's okay. I'm retired now, so I can say these things, right?
Joke.
I'm gonna get a call from HR. I know it.
we joke because there was one of the very first times we talked to anybody who worked for Disney. They had started to tell some story, and the Zoom or whatever we were using, it was probably Zoom connection, like froze. And Teresa and I looked at each other. We said, "Disney's on to them. They're cutting the connection."
Yeah.
But I was curious, I have three general things. And the first one leads in from our just conversation a second ago. Mm. As somebody who's worked on attractions before, what's your opinion of themed lands like a Tomorrowland, an Adventureland, a Fantasyland versus a Galaxy's Edge, a Pandora, a Cars Land?
Right.
You're
talking about the difference between a land themed around an idea versus themed around a story and a specific story, right? And I don't know. I love both. All right. I mean, I want to believe that there's a place for both. Now, I say that, and Tomorrowland has always been problematic, but problematic for different reasons, right? Not because it's themed around an idea, but because the idea of creating a Tomorrowland, as soon as you create it, it's yesterday land, right? I mean, I worked on a project that never saw the light of day. It was called Tomorrowland 2055. And we were going to level, essentially, not level is probably too strong a word, but we were going to completely redo Disneyland Tomorrowland. And we had...
Woo! And the crowd goes wild.
And the crowd goes wild. Oh, and it was a Tony Baxter-led project, and it was... You know, a lot of really brilliant people were working on it.
I just want to say quickly, this is airing after the D23 Expo. We might, at this point when this airs, we might have a design for a new Tomorrowland, maybe. Or I seem completely crazy at this point.
I can tell you, ever since I've been with the company, there has always been people trying to reimagine Tomorrowland.
I'm sure it's just like the thorn in a lot of Imagineers' sides. Like, we got to do something. There's so much potential.
We're not dummies. So, I mean, we see it, right? We walk out there and we're like, we'd like to be better, right? We'd like to do something. But then again, you go back to that. I have a finite amount of money. I can only spend so much and I only have so much time. Where do I put it? And so Space Mountain's going to draw people no matter what, right? So you, mm-hmm. you just go, Space Mountain's great. How much am I going to mess with that? The rest of it, you kind of go, I don't know. you know, Star Tours was such a fabulous attraction for so long. But now that we have Galaxy's Edge and Rise of the Resistance and Millennium Falcon, you kind of look at Star Tours and go, should we keep it? Should we do something else? But, you know, the whole branching technology and the additional stories they've been able to add, to me, I think have kept it fresh and kept it interesting and relevant. You just have to kind of make yourself good with the idea that those two different things exist. But the idea of a land based on an idea as opposed to a specific location of Fantasyland, Adventureland, right? Frontierland, though Frontierland is problematic in many other ways. Tomorrowland. I love that because what happens when you get a specific story, you know, and you theme around a story like Raider Springs or Galaxy's Edge or, you know, even some of the stuff that we did, Mysterious Island is probably a good example in Tokyo DisneySea. You've locked yourself in now. Mm-hmm. You, expansion, renovation, refreshing attractions, you're stuck. You have one story you're telling, and that's your story. And anything you want to do has got to fit that story. Where if I'm in Fantasyland, I can tell a whole bunch of different stories that fall under the auspices of fantasy. If I'm in Adventureland, adventure, boy, that covers a whole bunch of stuff, right? And I can tell all kinds of stories in Adventureland. Tomorrowland, same thing. So the flexibility that a land that's based on an idea as opposed to a specific place or story, I think just makes sense to me. I love that. As much as I'm a big fan of the immersion of Galaxy's Edge. I'm a big fan of the immersion of Pandora. Those are beautiful, beautiful works of art, in my opinion. You've locked yourself in. And so the only thing to do if Pandora ever wears out, nobody wants to go there anymore, or if Galaxy's Edge wears out, nobody wants to go there anymore, you've got to scrape it and start over.
Yeah.
Right?
That's my big concern is, these are great Marvels and everybody loves Star Wars and Marvel right now, but unlike something like the Jungle Cruise that's coming up on 70 years old, you know, are these still going to be popular 70 years from now? I mean, they could be, but we don't know. It just seems like a gamble.
It is, but it's a smart gamble because these are very strong stories. Pandora, Star Wars, these are very, very strong stories. So they're going to, don't feel sorry for them. They're going to make their money. They're going to do great. They're going to be very popular. And it's only as a storyteller, as a designer, that I worry about it because, when it comes times to refresh that, the company will be totally happy to refresh it. It'll just have to be something completely new. Unless those stories continue to grow in other ways that allow them to refresh and tell something different using the same attractions.
Yeah.
And same
life. Batu, since they locked themselves in the Star Wars universe, but not at a specific point, they still have some flexibility there versus, Pandora right now is, yes, we're getting more movies, but right now it's the one. Or like Cars Land, you kind of, it's a tighter lane, but yeah. So it'll be, I'm curious to see how, what the longevity is of these. But yeah, I mean, look at Cars Land. How old is Cars Land now? And it's still
10 years.
Just as popular, if not more, than the day it opened. It's incredible.
I chalk that up to that team. They did a beautiful job. By the way, again, that was Robert Coltrane, Kevin Rafferty, creative director, show writer on Raider Springs Racers. They just did a brilliant job on that.
Yeah.
The whole team that created the land, the placemaking, every aspect of that is just it's spot on. You are in the movie. Right. And I'm going to give a shout out to my friend Ken Lennon, the line designer for that land. Ken creates the moment at dusk where all the lights come on.
Teresa loves this.
It is the most magical moment as far as I'm concerned. And so Ken did that. And I still sing his praises every time I get an opportunity, because I don't know that people know to just put yourself in that land during that moment when the sun starts to set and those lights come on and they play the music and you're transported to that time in the movie when that happens. It's mm-hmm. it's magical.
Teresa Thank makes a you. Point every trip.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Thank you for giving us a name to the person that's behind that magical moment, because it's just, like you said, it's magical. And it's kind of like this insider secret. They don't advertise that it happens. Nope. So I would love to somehow not have ever experienced it and be the guest that just happens to be in the land right. and have it happen like organically for me. That would just be like, I mean, even the people that are standing there waiting, everyone just kind of just time stands still when the mm-hmm. lighting ceremony mm-hmm. happens.
Yeah.
Disneyland's so great and dark. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wish that there was more like 24-hour days where it was open, because I would love to just sleep during the day and just be in the park at night.
No, you don't. No, you don't. No, you don't.
I love Disneyland at night, though. It's so beautiful.
I do too, but keeping the park open 24 hours is a horrible
Oh
thing.
No, I get that part. But I'm saying like horrible. I just want more nighttime time in the park. It never seems when I was going to the parks when I was younger, it was back in the time when the parks would stay open till 1 a.m. and I loved that. Mm-hmm. But now it's like midnight's like they're cut off and that's that. All right.
Yeah.
Disney parks, especially in the United States. We just found out about Magic Key stuff a couple days ago. Yep. Something that I've been touting forever, and I want your opinion on if this will ever happen, is that Disney needs to create another US-based Disney resort somewhere that has parks, because they have a demand issue, so they keep raising the prices and doing all this stuff because they say that we have a very popular product. Well, the only way to keep prices down and kind of spread that around would be to build another resort somewhere, right? Question mark.
Yeah, this is an area where I tread dangerously into area. And well, no, it's an area that I really don't know.
Sure.
This is why it's your opinion.
Right? It's just my opinion. There's really smart people who look at this, who go, where do you put a park? Because think about it, our smallest park draws 5 million people annual, mm-hmm. right? Smallest. And you need to do at least that or more for it to become a viable venture, at least in the current business model of what a theme park is. Now, who's to say that Disney doesn't come up with a totally different type of experience? And we've tried, right? We've tried different things. If you think about, gosh darn it, I'm old. So
Disney Quest?
Disney Quest, thank you. Thank you. God bless you. You read my mind. Disney Quest was designed to be that, right? It was designed to be a smaller product that could pop up into different markets and not take people away from wanting to visit Disney World or Disneyland, but bring them a Disney experience. And for various reasons, it just wasn't successful. It didn't hit the mark. And there were several, there was a thing called Club Disney that we played with in the 90s. That didn't quite work out. At some point, I'm going to bet they figure out a different product that isn't a full castle park, right? Mm-hmm. Because our entry into every market has been a castle park, right? So you say that's kind of a blueprint of success. You go into a market, you put a castle park in first, you see how that does, you expand it, and then see how far you can grow with it. If there's enough demand, you add another gate and add something else to it. There might be something else they think of for other markets where a castle park doesn't make sense. And, you know, as long as I was at Imagineering, there were always ideas floating around of what that could be. It's just that nothing really kind of caught fire, right? And made everybody go, yeah, that's the thing. Let's get behind that. But that's not to say it won't happen. You look at the people who are playing in location-based entertainment right now, and I'm not saying the big ones like Universal, right? I mean, Universal does fantastic work, but think about people like Meow Wolf. I don't know if you are familiar with them, but they're a Santa Fe-based arts collective who created this amazing experience in Santa Fe, and it caught fire, largely because of just the brilliance of who they are. But then they also kind of created a mix of art and theme park experience that is just, it's very hard to describe in a conversation like this. I suggest you and your listeners check them out. They are kind of the new Disney. They opened a Meow Wolf location in Las Vegas and Denver, and they are a very interesting experience. And it's those types of people who are experimenting with the idea of location-based entertainment and what that means and how you tell stories in an interactive experience that I think will push Disney to look at what they do and how they do things a little differently. Now, when you're as big as Disney, it's very hard to break the process of what you've always done, right? Because the machine gets created with that in mind, with the idea of we know how to do a theme park, let's do a theme park. We know how to do attractions, let's do that. We got into cruise ships, now we understand cruise ships. Okay, let's do cruise ships. We got that. Even resort hotels like Aulani, right? You go, yeah, we know how to do a resort hotel. That's good. It's hard to be nimble, though. It's hard to, you know, do that little small thing that then catches fire and grows into something big. But I wouldn't underestimate them either. I bet you they think of something.
I just looked that up. We will have a link in our show notes for Meow Wolf. But yeah, that just the photos on their website are just very like intriguing. That's like, what is this?
And I'll give you a little bit more reason to check them out. Probably about, I'll give you a number and it won't mean anything, but a large amount of their staff is ex-Imagineers.
Oh. That's a great reason to go then.
There's a whole bunch of ex-Imagineers working for them right now. But yeah, there's ex-Imagineers doing really cool stuff everywhere, mm-hmm, right? So you think about the location-based entertainment industry really took off when a whole bunch of Imagineers found themselves out of work in the 70s and 80s and went and started creating their own industry, their own business, and started doing things on their own. Now, Universal helped a lot, and other kinds of location experiences helped a lot. But you think about that industry that got created in the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm, those people grew up and they all went on and did other things and continue to do other things. And while I still hold Disney as the platinum standard for all things theme park, location-based entertainment, they're going to be a hard one to knock off that pedestal. There's a whole bunch of people thinking about it, and there's a whole bunch of people playing in that industry right now trying to come up with the next cool thing. And there's a lot of cool stuff out there.
Yeah.
Just at a different scale, right?
I think that's good, though, because then it kind like, you know, then everybody's kind of just
I mean, you know, from a Disney perspective, we love that stuff because it keeps us fresh, and we go look at all of it and check it out and devour it because it feeds our energy. It feeds our soul. There's a group out of Tokyo I love called Team Lab that does these really amazing interactive experiences that are all media based, and they're sublime and nuanced in ways that is just hard for people to understand. But they are taking the world by storm, one installation at a time. They started in Tokyo. They've got places in, Singapore, Shanghai, Beijing, and now Florida, Miami. And I won't be surprised to see more of them in the U.S. soon.
Wow. Tay, did you have one more kind of in your Greg's opinion land? Mine is outside of opinion land.
Oh, okay. Then I have one last opinion land question.
Yes. Sure, go ahead.
So this is probably going to be similar to the question I just asked you. do you think that... I'm pretty sure I know the answer, but I'm just curious. Do you think that Disney will ever have an agreement with anybody else like they did with Oriental Land Company? Or is that like a one and done? They want to operate their own stuff.
God bless you. Yeah, I love that question. That's a great question because I love that agreement we have with OLC. I think it's a fabulous agreement.
Well, you'd think Disney would like it too because it gets their name out there and they get paid licensing, I assume, for it. And the other people like pick up the bill for the thing, basically.
It And again, here I am talking about something I'm really ill-equipped to talk about, right?
That's why it's opinion land.
It's opinion land only. What I see with Oriental Land Company and with Japan is so unique, and I'm not sure it can be replicated. Hmm. OLC, in many ways, is more Disney than Disney.
Hmm.
They care so much about the product. They care so much about the quality that they've taken what we've taught them and what we've shown them to be the way we do things at Disney, and they have strived to perfect it and do it better than anybody else. They have such a pride in what they do. So that agreement that says, oh, see, this is your money, you're going to license us our characters, our name, our IP, we are going to design, you're going to do all the hard work, because truly they do, right? I mean, mm-hmm. our job, when you work on a project with OLC, the easy job is the design. The hard part's the implementation, the operation afterwards. Now, a lot of my colleagues right now are also writing me nasty emails going, Greg, do you know how hard it is to work with OLC? Yes, I know. I sat in all the video conferences until odd hours of the night, and I've sat in all those meetings with interpreters where it takes twice as long to get your point across because you're having to interpret everything from Japanese mm-hmm. to English and English to Japanese. And so, yes, I know all that. But still, OLC does a lot of heavy lifting. They do an amazing job. And it would take lightning striking again to find another. I'm not saying it's a cultural thing. I'm just saying it's a company thing. That company decided that was an important thing to them and they wanted that. And so we would have to find somebody else somewhere who said, this product, this company of Disney is important to us and we want to preserve it and maintain it as well as you do. I don't know how you do that today. And I don't know that we knew we were doing it when it happened. You know, OLC approached us in the 60s and asked us to build Tokyo Disneyland. And we sent them packing and said, go away. We're busy. We have no time for you. And they kept coming back and coming back and coming back and coming back and persisted and said, we're not going to rest until you guys give us the go ahead. So finally in the 70s, they said, all right, we just finished Walt Disney World. That's done and open. We're thinking about this thing called Epcot, but we'll figure out how to shoehorn you guys in. So very much the same way DCA and TDS got built at the same time, mm-hmm. Epcot and TDL got built at the same time.
Oh.
They were parallel projects, and a whole bunch of people got their career chance on TDL because the A-team got put on Epcot. And I say that, and everybody on TDL now is going to write me a nasty letter. I was part of the A-team, right? But truly, the people that had been around a while and the people that were the most experienced were all working on Epcot. And the company signed this deal to do Tokyo Disneyland. And a whole bunch of people who had never been to Japan before and didn't know anything about Japan were suddenly getting assigned. And then the company started recruiting Imagineers left and right to find people who could work on Tokyo Disneyland. And the conceit they had at the time was, well, you know what we'll do? We'll just take the Magic Kingdom drawings out of the drawer. We'll lift that. We'll make some changes. And we'll give them Magic Kingdom. And that's what they tried to do. And then it morphed into this thing that became Tokyo Disneyland. And lightning struck. And I don't think anybody knew. If anybody says they knew it was going to happen, I think they're lying. I don't think anybody knew lightning was going to strike the way it did, but it did. And it's turned into the most popular park in all of Disney, right? I mean, Tokyo Disneyland, DisneySea are more popular than any of our other destinations. And I say that also, and there's probably others who are going to argue with me too, but I can tell you, no, they're the most popular.
it's really incredible when you like think about it, because Disney had to just kind of put a lot of faith, hope, and pixie dust into you know, the Oriental Land Company.
There was
you know what I mean? It's just
but there was no risk, right? The company had no risk other than their brand, which they were like, well, you know, we'll tell them to close if it's terrible,
that's
right?
True.
If they
don't do a good job. True.
But we're not putting any money up. It's not a dime of Disney money is going into this. It's all theirs. They want to take the risk. Okay, fine. Well,
that's a good way of saying it. I always think of the whole, like, we're going to hand you this very special thing. Please don't break it.
And you're absolutely right, Teresa. I mean, the brand identity, you can't restore people's trust once you break it.
Yeah.
So we always take that very seriously. Mm-hmm. We can't ruin the trust that people have in us. And we understand how important that is. But I mean, I'm sure I wasn't around then, right, when they made those deals, but I'm sure they felt like the risk was very small.
Yeah. Well, and I think the fact that the Oriental Land Company was so persistent, kept coming, that also probably made Disney go, well, these guys are pretty, like, they're not going away. They really, like,
yeah,
this is a deep, deep desire, deep want, need, whatever you want to call it. Like, right. This is a big, big, big deal for them, and they're not going to take no for an answer. I'm sure that spoke volumes to them as well.
I'm sure it did. That kind of earnestness and you know, having experienced that firsthand and working with then the successors in that company, and how much that carried forward with everybody who works there, how much they still to this day believe in it. It's awe-inspiring, and it's why it was my favorite place to work, because when I worked there, I felt like I was just part of this like-minded community who all cared deeply about the product. And it just was a joy, an absolute joy to be part of that.
My last question before we wrap up with our final question. I feel like we can't have been talking about Tokyo Disneyland without mentioning Duffy.
Oh.
I don't understand Duffy at all. I will tell you, I don't know very much about Duffy, but Duffy fascinates me because Duffy is, to us, you know, this unknown character, but so much popularity, has a whole group of friends now, and it's very unique to
Tokyo. They tried to bring him to DCA for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that didn't go well, did it? No. Though Duffy is a unique phenomenon. And again, I think lightning struck in Japan in ways that I mean, I think there's some popularity in Hong Kong and Shanghai, but really Tokyo is the home of Duffy and the home of Duffy's friends. Now, Duffy got its start actually in Walt Disney World. It was originally called the Disney Bear. And there was a whole backstory on the Disney Bear. I believe it was Mickey's bear that he brought to the Magic Kingdom with him because he was lonely. Now, stop and think about that for a second. Mickey lonely? I'm like, hang on. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm probably making somebody mad somewhere who loved that story.
Seems like you love that, apparently.
Right. But the idea was that Mickey went to the Magic Kingdom and was enjoying his experience and wish he had some friends to share his experience with. And then Tinkerbell heard Mickey's thoughts and came down and sprinkled pixie dust on the bear and brought the bear to life. Right. That, I think I'm probably screwing the story up royally, but that was my
understanding
of it.
Something along those lines. Yeah.
So I was actually living in Tokyo when this all came up. And so there was a merchandise director at the time by the name of Ed Storen. Great guy who was over there in Tokyo as the merchandise leader. And he knew of the Disney Bear in Florida. And he, in watching guests' interactions in the parks and understanding the experience in Japan, he thought the Disney Bear would do very well. Because it's a beautiful plush bear, right? I mean, it's really well made. It's, you know, just a nice bear, right? And so he came to us at WDI and said, hey, I want to bring this bear, but I know you guys can help me craft a story around it and give it a place to live and maybe give it a little bit more meaning. And I thought that was very smart to do that, because I think whether that was Ed's idea originally or somebody else's, I don't know, but all I know is by doing that, it put a sense of importance, and it gave the bear a sense of meaning to the Japanese audience that helped it resonate and in ways that we just didn't understand at the time. Now, at that time, I was working SQS. Joanne Cicero was the creative executive in charge of Tokyo. And so Joe had a writer and some folks in Glendale come up with a story, and they created a little storybook about Duffy the bear, and that the story was that we were going to put the bear in Cape Cod, which is one of the little lands, kind of a, almost a subland to American waterfront in Tokyo Disney Sea. And in Cape Cod, Mickey is a fisherman. And Mickey would go out on these fishing voyages. And so Minnie made a bear for Mickey to keep him company on his voyages. And Mickey would dream at night about the bear coming to life, and they would go on these fantastic adventures together. And then he would wake up, and there would be the bear sitting there. And he wouldn't know, did I dream that, or did it really happen? So this was all in this little storybook that was created by Joe and his team. And then Joe came to us and said, hey, let's find a place for it and figure out how we do it. So there was a retail shop in Cape Cod called Aunt Peg's that nobody went to and sold a bunch of merchandise that nobody cared about because it was all like New England-y, you know,
sure.
Harbor stuff. And the Japanese were like, why do we care about this? This means nothing to us. And we had all kinds of different ideas. Like we were going to make it a Build-A-Bear experience, you know, where you made your own Duffy and then – you know, took that out. That became too complicated. And so we just said, well, let's just introduce Duffy here. And we put a little storybook with him that got sold with the bear. None of us thought this was going to work. And by the way, OLC hated the idea. Can I tell you that? And I hope OLC is listening to me telling me this story right now, because they, to this day, they claim credit, right? They say, well, we love Duffy. We always thought Duffy was fantastic. And I'm telling you right now, they hated it. They thought this was a stupid idea. And they were like, we'll give you a couple of shelves in the merchandise shop, but that's it. And you guys are idiots for thinking that this is going to work.
Like, good luck with this.
Right? And honestly, I didn't think it was that great of an idea myself at the time, right? I was like, well, it's cute, it's fine, but I don't, you know.
And then it took off.
And then the next thing I know, everybody had to have a bear. And not just the bear, you had to have the clothes. And because we couldn't keep merchandise in stock, they started making their own clothes for Duffy. And then it grew this whole way of interacting with Duffy, where Duffy took on a life of its own, where we had to start creating high chairs in restaurants for people to put their Duffy in.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So that when you would dine at the restaurant, you had to have a place for your Duffy to sit to experience your meal with you. Or when you went to see a live show, Duffy would occupy a seat with you. So Duffy essentially became a family member.
Yeah.
And would experience the park with you. And then we created photo ops throughout the park where you could place your Duffy and you could get your picture taken with you and Duffy experiencing the park together.
Wow.
Duffy's even like bigger than I realized.
Oh,
I knew Duffy was popular, but wow.
Yeah, I've been gone from the company since 21, so I don't have the current numbers.
Sure.
But I can tell you it was a significant share of the overall merchandise sales for Japan. And Japan sells more Disney merchandise than all domestic parks combined. So when you think about that for a second, and you think about how Duffy is a significant player, and you know, probably more important to the Japanese parks than Mickey and Minnie. Certainly more so than Winnie the Pooh or any of the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really an amazing phenomenon, which I don't know can be replicated anywhere else.
Right.
It is uniquely Tokyo Disney Sea. It's not sold in Tokyo Disneyland. The bears only, it only, and this is OLC, bless their hearts. They do Disney better than Disney. They say this bear exists only in Tokyo Disney Sea. The friends only exist in Tokyo Disney Sea. There's only one place you can get it. That's in Tokyo Disney Sea. Can't get it in Disneyland.
Yeah.
Not there.
Wow.
Doesn't exist.
See, Teresa, there's your thing, because you were saying that you like when Disney only puts things in like one place.
I do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You just need to hang out with Oriental Land Company.
Yep. I like the uniqueness of each park, and I want each park to be unique, because that's why it's special. And so, yeah, there you go. Right there. Wow. That was incredible. Thank you for sharing the story and the background of Duffy. Duffy is so much more than I knew Duffy was popular, and I knew Duffy was very special to the Tokyo parks, but I did not, or well, to Tokyo Disney Sea now specifically.
So much so that they've even now started to create animation shorts that they show only in Japan that are Duffy and Friends.
Wow. And, that's amazing.
And the stories are being written by Imagineers.
Yeah.
So that's Charlie cool. Watanabe, who's the show writer for Imagineering and from Japan originally and writes for now the Tokyo Portfolio, has been writing shorts for Duffy and Friends. And wow. They're brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant.
That kind of wow. We kind of just went full circle. We were talking about IP versus yep. You know, an original thought, and look at how that original thought just was kind of a, well, we'll see, and bam. Hmm. Dang. Very cool.
Wow. I mean, I feel like they're, I mean, we could talk for another 2 or 3 hours, I'm sure. But we'll end this conversation here because yeah. I feel like it's getting late for everybody. Sure. And so we'll get to our last question, which is, if you could work at Disneyland, what would you do? So the sky's the limit, could be any job, even a made up one. What would you do?
I love that question. I that's probably my favorite one. I had a good friend of mine who was also, he and I started in show set together, David Emister. And David used to tell me his favorite job was, because I don't know if you guys know, we used to do for Christmas, they used to close the park and Imagineering would get the park to themselves, right?
Oh.
Now, when we would do that, they would ask if some of the Imagineers could come down and work some of the rides, be cast members, right? To also, you know, give the Disneyland cast members a break and not yeah. let them have to work those hours. And we were always, we loved that. We were like, oh my God, yes, let us, I want to be a ride op or I want to work in an attraction or something. Well, my friend David, he always wanted to be a custodian on Main Street. That was his favorite job. And I stopped and I thought about that. I'm like, what a cool thing, right? Because you're part of creating this ambiance mm-hmm. of a place. You're giving life to it by being that person who is there, you know, sweeping up the trash, but interacting with the guests, mm-hmm. creating this whole sense of place in that. And I love David's articulation of that. I thought that was so cool. But I never got to do that. I actually, when I volunteered, they just assigned me to something. And I ended up being a ride operator on the Mark Twain.
Mm.
And I have to say, I loved it. It was so much fun because now I'm going to tell a little, I don't know if this is a secret or not.
Magic spoiler.
The cast members who worked there on a regular basis, they called it the floating break room. Because really, once you launch from the dock, you've got a nice 15-minute break, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's going around the river. Now, you know, they would make announcements and stuff, and they would have some fun with the guests and stuff like that. But it was so lovely and relaxing, and you just got to sit back and enjoy the scenery going around Rivers of America. And I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. This is really a pretty cool job. So
the floating breaker.
I have to say Mark Twain, Rivers of America.
And what, I mean, it's such a beautiful, beautiful area of the park too. You know, the rivers, yes, of course, but then looking out over, you know, New Orleans Square, watching the logs come splashing down Splash Mountain.
Don't say that to the 5-year-old, Teresa.
No. Yeah. So it is. It's a very unique perspective.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure a lot of people would be like, oh, I'd love to be, in Indiana Jones, or I'd love to be in Haunted Mansion or something like that. But those are high-pressure jobs, right? I mean, I'm not saying that there's not pressure on the Mark Twain, right? But I mean, when you're responsible for an e-ticket that, you know, has very tight dispatch intervals and there's safety concerns and loading and unloading guests in the frequency that they do, wow. That's bless her hearts. Those folks are, that's hard. And so I love those sublime moments, those moments where you can just sit back and relax and just enjoy the experience, you know, whether I'm a custodian on Main Street or I'm for the Mark Twain and I'm just enjoying being mm-hmm. right. That to me is what's beautiful about the park.
Our poor little hearts were so broken because we found out that you can get up into the wheelhouse or whatever, like one, you know, before the pandemic,
right?
You know, one family or group could go up there per, you know, rotation or whatever.
That's so magical that they do.
We came in and the cast member's like, you have to find the captain. I'm like, well, what does the captain look like? They're like, you got to find the captain. And we found the captain. like 2 seconds after this other person had found the captain and got to go up. And so I just remember being so heartbroken because there was that. And then there was the time we tried to get on the Lily Bell, but they were just taking it out of service or something. And it was just like, oh, we just missed it. Like, I don't know. We have poor luck with these things, I think. But
I'm sorry.
That's all right. It'll happen eventually. Eventually.
That's
it'll
what
be
makes
cool.
them special magicals, that it's a rare occurrence to be able to experience and do.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk with us and share your stories. They were incredible, and we really enjoyed our time.
Oh, I love this. You wind me up and you get me going. I'll talk all night. So happy to do it. Love you guys. Imagineers, we love the passion that we engender in the people who come to the parks. And so for what you guys provide, we just absolutely love that. We think that's terrific, and it makes us feel like we're doing our job right.
You guys are incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Well, I mean, you create so many happy memories for everybody. You know, it's just, what a job to be able to be part of something that is going to be like an indelible thing on so many people's in so many people's minds.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And believe me, we know how special it is. And I think I speak for anybody who's ever been an Imagineer. We just cherish that. It's what makes us so special, is we take that very seriously. It's almost like a responsibility. It's like, oh my God, we're part of something that's much bigger than us, right? We're just a small little part of a much bigger thing.
Looks like we're coming in for a landing, gang. But please stay listening until trivia comes to a stop, and then yous can walk to the nearest exit. Thanks for listening to the 8th Wonder of the World, DL Weekly.
Welcome back to Trivia Land, where we're going to find out the answers to those questions from before.
Which I'm sure we didn't
I don't think we gave now, them to you, no.
Now that we've heard the questions, how do we feel about how we did tonight?
Awful.
Awful.
I'm going to be so excited if we got a full question right. I don't even know. Even those two-parters, I'm not even confident we got a full two-parter.
Well, I can tell you this, Teresa, you will be excited then.
I think our only hope is the Haunted Mansion holiday.
Your only hope, probably.
I think our only hope is that.
Well, let's dive into it then, shall we? Your first listener submitted question from listener Chris Y. What is the name of the pirate in the Pirates of the Caribbean ride who offers rum to the cats? Teg said Drunk Pete, and Teresa said Drunk Dave. The correct answer that we were looking for was Old Bill.
Old Bill. Yep, I did not know that.
Descriptor and a common name. Old Bill. Hmm. Yep.
Well, wasn't the guy's name from the movie William something? Probably. I feel like there's probably a lot of
Williams.
Was Orlando Bloom's character. Yeah. But I think there was more. Anyway, doesn't matter.
Your second regular round question submitted by listener Keith N. What is a common cast member nickname for the Main Street vehicles? Tag said funiculars, and Teresa said the wheels. The correct answer that we were looking for, taken from the book Secret Stories of Disneyland by Jim Corcus, the cast members call them the Germobiles.
Germobiles. Ooh, makes me think a little differently about riding in a Main Street vehicle.
Make sure you bring your hand sanitizer and
the germ mobiles.
You
huh?
think about how many people go
that's
on and off of
that's any attraction
those,
vehicle,
and...
though.
That's true.
Yeah, but
I would also say that attraction vehicles probably have more guests than them than the Main Street vehicles. But yes,
that's what the book says, apparently. Your third regular round question submitted by Louise B. In the Haunted Mansion Holiday Overlay, what replaces Madame Leota's musical instruments, and how many objects are there? Teg said there were 6 fortune cards, and Teresa said there are 13 cards with a couple Nightmare Before Christmas characters. The correct answer that I was looking for is 13 tarot cards, which is basically a fortune card, with Nightmare Before Christmas characters on them.
Good job.
So did we get it?
You
I
did.
Gave Teg half credit for getting tarot cards, fortune cards, And I gave Teresa full credit for 13 cards with nightmare characters.
Woohoo!
Good job.
That was our one hope.
Good job, Teresa.
And your fourth and final regular round question from listener Cooper C. When was the Fred Gurley number 3 engine built? And what was its original job before coming to Disneyland? Teg said 1893, and Teresa said 1863, and you both said for hauling lumber. The correct answer that we were looking for was, built in 1894, the Fred Gurley No. 3 was a switch engine on the Godchow Sugar Company mill before being purchased by Disney in 1957.
Sugar Company.
So is it a lumber mill?
No, it's a sugar
mill. Company sugar mill.
Dang it. I just heard mill and got
excited. I was
excited.
Off by a year.
That was pretty darn good.
I will give Teg half credit for being off by only a year.
Good job.
So I have 1 point and you have 1 point.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Woo!
You have a very generous 1 point.
All right. Our bonus. Maybe this can give us our extra point.
Your bonus question provided by listener Cooper C. How much was the Fred Gurley number 3 purchased for in $1957? Teg said $7,000 in $1957, and Teresa said $20,000 in $1957. The correct answer that I was looking for was $1,200.
Oh my gosh, $1,200. Wow. I know it was 1957, but think about how much money they spent to build the entire park.
That's true.
So I feel like $1,200 for an engine is, wow.
But for a piece of history that is still around.
No. But I mean, like, I feel like that's low. I really would have thought that would have been higher. No,
true.
I don't know. They got a deal.
They were probably scrapping it.
I guess I don't know the value of engines.
Yeah, I would have thought higher.
Well, listeners, how do you feel about how they did? How do you feel about how you did at home? Do you think you've got the perfect question that can really stump them next week? If you think you've got that perfect question, feel free to send that in to us at trivia@dlweekly.net.
Well, we will be back next week with more Disneyland news and information.
Until then, go out and enjoy the parks.
Please remain seated until the podcast comes to a complete stop and the doors have opened. Then collect your belongings, watch your head, and step carefully from the episode. On behalf of all of our crew, thanks for traveling with us. And we hope you have a happy and memorable visit here at DL Weekly.